Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, anyone in between, and all those still trying to figure it the fuck out, please sit back, relax, put in your earphones, and buckle your seatbelts. The next 2 hours are guaranteed to not be safe for work. Now welcome to your speakers, smartphones, or laptop, America's sweetheart, Pollo Del Mar, and San Francisco's blazing beauty, Pearl Tees. It's time for Podomatic's number one ranked LGBT podcast, and 120 minutes of your life you will never get back. Brought to you in conjunction with San Francisco's Left Magazine, it's time for Party Foul Radio with Pollo and Pearl.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Party Foul Radio. I'm your co-host, Ms. Pollo Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Teeth.
This is episode 64, everyone.
All right, 64.
Yes. Pearl needs to get close to the microphone because we know she's got some quiet issues. Ooh. Oh, girl!
Girl, you always have a motherfucking rig chair that I'm sitting in. What is this?
If only she had fallen on the actual floor. She just nearly toppled to the side. Oh, but that would have been so good. If you'd fallen on the floor, I would have been, like, it would have been 2 full hours of just nothing but me laughing. And we'd
have no idea. Like, do you have any, like, actual safe furniture in here?
No, do you want me to go get some lawn furniture?
I would.
Hold, please. And we're back. I had to go outside and get a nice little lawn chair thing for Pearl to sit on. It looks like a little captain's chair. It's so cute.
Okay.
Oh, a director's chair. Yes, a director's chair.
Anyway.
Whew, girl, it's a heat wave here.
It's a heat wave in San Francisco, girl. It's about time that the sun came out, but it came back. It came out with a vengeance, bitch.
It sure did. I'm thinking about stripping down to my underwear so I can just sit here in nothing but my underwear.
Girl, I can't wait till I go home. I live right by the beach, you guys.
That's true. She does. It'll be cold AF out there, bitch.
No,
probably.
Girl, it's not. Like, it gets really hot out there.
But you guys have to understand, when I first moved to San Francisco in 1999, I was like, why is it that you can get a place near the beach here so affordable? Because in Southern California, it's very costly to live near the beach. Like, very, very costly. But here, it's quite affordable because, drumroll, nobody wants to go in the damn water because it's hella cold. And also, like, it's a lot, very foggy out in that area or whatever. But there are benefits when it's nice.
Right. People often think that about the sunset and even the Richmond, but it's not always that. And sometimes San Francisco is so off the hook with its weather. Like, it can be sunny in one neighborhood and foggy in the next. So sometimes even it could be foggy, like, downtown, and it'll be nice in my area.
Yeah, there have been...
It's incredible.
Most of the time, the area of town I live in is a little chillier than, like, the Castro, for example. But in San Francisco, it is notorious, you guys. If you go from one neighborhood to the other, the temperature will literally just change no matter where you are. It's like...
Right.
And so the Mission District is much warmer.
Usually always
nice. Yeah, it's like quite a bit nicer and whatever. Anyway, it's quite warm. I don't know what it maxed out at today, but it's been warm. And the thing about San Francisco is we are so used to very moderate temperatures. Like, if it gets a little cold, we're like, oh my God, it's freezing. And if it gets a little warm, we're like, oh my God, it's burning up.
Right.
We just don't know what to do with ourselves. Anyway, this past weekend, you guys, was the going away party for Putanesca, Jose Guzman Colon, at Mother. You weren't there.
I was not there.
Pearl no-showed.
Yes, girl. I didn't show up. But sent her a message on her way. I love that girl so much.
Mm-hmm.
She is going out to New York. We are all going to miss her here in San Francisco.
We surely will. Remember, guys, we had Kay Flay on with us for an interview a few weeks back? Well, I performed her song Blood in the Cut, and it came off exactly like I wanted in my head. It was pretty incredible. So I couldn't believe that I actually brought it to life the way I did. And I have a fabulous video of it. Unfortunately, the lighting is dreadful. So everything, the lighting's out to get a bitch. But Martha Tang, Kay Flay's publicist, wants me to send her a link. She wants me to upload it on YouTube and send her a link because she wants to send it to Kay. So I'm gonna do that.
Hopefully it'll make her laugh or something, girl.
It was really dramatic. It wasn't my normal campy number. It was pretty dramatic, kind of dark and twisted. So, but it was a wonderful night for Jose's going away party. It was like everybody on the stage that night had at least 10 years of experience doing drag. which is very different than most of the shows, which are like a lot of newer.
Was that your way of saying that everyone on stage was at least 40 or 50 years old?
I'm saying that you can definitely tell the difference in a dressing room when it is full of seasoned veteran performers. It's very chill. There's no chaos. There's no, like, drama there. I mean, for most of us, we've been... the last time that group of people had performed all together was back when Trainee Shack was at the Stud, like, a long time ago. Like,
why don't you guys perform together anymore?
Well, because some of the people have been retired for, like, you know, and they're not even old. They just stopped performing. Other people, like, seldom perform. It was a lineup of performers that was hand-selected by Jose. So he picked some of his favorite performers from many, many years ago, some of them. But it was so fantastic. I got to see, like, Peggy Legs. Honey Mahogany was in the show. Phonique was in the show. Trixie Carr was in the show. It was just such a good show. It was a really, really good show. So if you guys were not there, you missed out. But, Jose, we wish you well on your journeys with Veronica Klaus in New York. So.
I just love Veronica. Shout out to Veronica also. Good luck out there.
Oh, my God. Gina LaDivina was on the show, too.
Oh, I love Gina.
I love Miss Gina LaDivina. And I said to her that night, I was like, you know, Gina, not to be shady, but my drag dad is moving away. I lost my drag grandma. I think I need some new family.
Girl,
so.
Nobody wants you.
Bitch, she said she'd be delighted for me to call her and sent me her phone number. So, Ms. Gina LaDivina, you will be getting a call from me this week sometime, boo, to set up a little... I want to go over there and, like, hang out with her and watch her style wigs. You guys, she's incredible.
She is incredible.
She's incredible.
Her apartment is amazing.
Yeah, it's like... I don't even know how to describe it. It's just so fabulous. Everything about her apartment is so fabulous. So, cannot wait. I'm looking forward to it, Ms. Gina. What did you do all weekend? What kept you from going to Jose's going away party, Queen?
I actually got tattooed and worked on my sleeve. And
she mentioned that last week, you guys.
Yeah, I was stuck in a tattoo artist chair for like 3 to 4 hours and got tatted up. I have like 2 more sessions to go. And it's I really like it. It turned out a little bit different from what we were originally going for, but it's coming out perfectly. I'll put up pictures after my next session, because I think right now we just have like
it's
a lot
just
of outlines.
Yeah.
But it's gorgeous.
Yeah, lean closer to that microphone, girl. I'm like...
Right, I'm looking at the bars and it's like...
low.
Anyway.
So, well, that's cool. That's good.
Other than that, I just hang out with my girlfriends. You know, that's it.
Well, very nice. I want to backtrack something that we did not have an opportunity to discuss last week. And I definitely want to kind of, like, give a recap of it. We had talked a few weeks back about the fact that I was going to be working, presenting for 2 days, a Saturday and a Sunday, this really intense documentary called Chemsex that we had Max Gogarty, who is the director of. We had him on the podcast to talk about the sex. I'm sorry, to talk about the film. Right, exactly. To talk about the film, which focuses on the intersection between intravenous crystal meth use and gay male sexuality. And so the first day it was showing in Oakland, I want to say the New Parkway Theater is the name of it. I love that theater space. If you are in the Bay Area, especially if you're in the East Bay and you get a chance to go to the New Parkway Theater, I'm praying that's the right name, go check it out. It's so cool. They have all this, it's very community focused and they have all these community related events there. Plus they show a movie on like a big screen. But they have, like, couches and armchairs. And it's like sitting in a big living room, like, with your friends talking and, like, you know, well, ideally not talking, but watching a movie. It's really cool. And the second day was at the Women's Building in San Francisco. Well, the first day I showed up over there in Oakland, and I kind of did not know what to expect. So 30 or so minutes into the film, you guys, I had to get up and leave. Like, I got up and left the theater. It is very intense. It's very graphic, very explicit, very sexual. It's no joke. And then I had to go decompress, you know, as a recovering addict. It was, I will say that it pressed a lot of my buttons in terms of not wanting to use. Like, it didn't make me want to go, oh God, I got to run out and, you know, shoot up or whatever, which is something I never did, by the way, you guys. But what it did do is, by watching kind of the absurdity of other people's behavior, it made me feel a lot of shame for potentially uncomfortable situations that I put myself in. Like, for example, there was this one scene very early in the film where this guy is talking to the filmmakers while he's injecting himself with drugs. And then instantaneously, he looks possessed and he's just like staring at them and like looking possessed, and then begins to masturbate. Mm-mm. Right in front of everybody. And while I never did that either, what it made me think about was, how many times
did you do something messy like that?
Well, what it made me think about specifically was how many times I would go to functions and I would be high and I thought nobody could see the difference. You know what I mean? You could clearly see how changed this particular man was from before and after, you know, before the drugs and after the drugs. And so that just made me feel really ashamed about, like, oh my God, like, job interviews, family functions, you know, reunion, all kinds of things that I did where I thought nobody knew, but I was like crazed. You know what I mean? Like, maybe not to that degree, but not myself. And then afterwards, we had a panel discussion with some incredible people on the panel, and I was the panel discussion leader. I was basically the moderator of the conversation, and we had so many really cool, really interesting people who were there to watch the film. And then there was such a huge level of participation in the conversation, super educational. On day two, knowing that the first 30 minutes was fucked up for me, I waited until like a little bit into it and then go back in and watch the film. And through the film, you meet the gentleman, his name is David, who runs a health services organization in London that directly interacts with people who are in their addiction, who are struggling with addiction-related issues, STIs, all of this HIV infection. The second part was very informative. There were some intense parts, but it was pretty amazing. And Max was really engaging. He was there. We just had a really good time. So to everyone who was involved in that, I really want to thank you. Damien, oh, this is really cool, girl. A gentleman named Damien, who is the manager of a bar in London, but also the head of this organization called Impulse in London. The Impulse organization here in San Francisco Bay Area put on the screening of the film. But Impulse in London is getting ready to do some series of events late in the summer. And he said, you know, we've been looking for somebody who can, like, do this adeptly. And I was really impressed. So he said, consider this like a two-day audition. I'm going to try to get you to be able to come over here to the UK to do this with us. So I'm like, come on, girl, let's do it.
Fine.
Boom. And you can put me up and give me a night of entertaining or something at your bar, Damien. Come on, baby.
Well, have you seen the entire film yet?
I saw the first part of it, and then I saw the second part of it, and there's probably like a few minutes of like in between that I haven't seen, but I'm not willing to go back in and like... There was another part towards the end where another guy is kind of like shooting up again also. And I did get up and go get a beverage during that part. I was like, it's just intense, you guys. But one of the things that I will say, and I don't want to go into too great of detail about it, but a friend of the show and a follower and supporter of mine in Europe, her name is Vibka. Shout out to Vibka. Told me that she's been dealing with a situation with her friend who is going through potentially similar issues. Mm-hmm. And she watched the film after hearing about it on the podcast, and she said it was remarkably helpful in her understanding potentially where her friend is at mentally and emotionally. Mm-hmm. So I think that makes it worthwhile, because really that's what the documentary they wanted to do. And Max actually said that one of the reasons he hasn't done a follow-up film, because this was, you know, they only put this out in 2015, so it's only been a couple years, but he said one of the reasons he has not attached his name or pushed for a follow-up film yet is because he realizes how impactful this film has been, and he wants something that connects to him and he connects to the material the way this intrigued him and made him, you know, he wants to do something useful, which I think is great, because a lot of people would get some acclaim and they'd be like, oh, better jump on it right away while I still have,
right,
you know.
Right.
So the other thing, Pearl, First of all, Max Gogarty is really cute. He's the director. And I found out, we all found out kind of simultaneously, he is straight. I had no idea. I was like, wait a minute.
Girl, the gag.
He said at one point, he was like, do you think you'd mistake me for gay? And I was like, well, honey, you're aware of the game we play around here, right? Like, gay or European? Come on now. Like, you can't tell the difference, girl. Anyway, he said that he usually doesn't get clocked as... nobody over there thinks that he's gay. And I was like, of course, you're from there.
Did he use the word clocked?
No. No, he said nobody in Europe ever mistakes him as being gay. But in the U.S., he said everybody mistakes him as being gay. And I was like, well, I think y'all have different standards over there. You know?
Well.
I think it's just because people tend to be potentially slightly more refined. And we think of those things as like, you know, in America, like to prove that you're straight, you have to like kill animals and... You know, go hunting and do all that crap. So, watch football.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't even know where this is going. But
anyway. Well, that's lovely. I mean, why did he decide to work on a project like this, him being straight?
Right. That was like the million-dollar question. And he said he didn't intend to make this film. He said that what happened was that he met David, the director of this organization that is a service organization.
Right.
And it provides service to the addiction community as well as the HIV community. And David's like a counselor who works there and he's the manager of the whole thing. So through talking to him, the organization was the first of its kind in all of the UK. So, oh, girl, sorry.
Oh.
So they wanted to do like a little piece about it on the BBC, the British Broadcast Corporation, y'all. You know, I got confused when I heard BBC
no,
too,
she
bitch.
Didn't.
I was like, ooh, BBC.
Girl,
not the BBC Three, bitch. Yes.
The Dark Shark over here.
Not the Dark Shark, girl. Oh, damn. Anyway, so they started out doing this short piece and then they put out a call, like, I don't know how they did it. Like, they just made a public posting saying anybody who wanted to talk about the subject matter could show up on a certain day and they could choose to either be videotaped or behind a screen to talk about their experiences. And they thought that they would get maybe, like, a couple people.
Uh-huh.
And thusly, it would be, like, maybe a 8-minute segment or whatever on BBC. But once they put out that call, they got a couple dozen people. And so all of a sudden they had all this material, and as it was coming in, they realized, well, we could make this into feature-length documentary.
And everyone happened to be gay, or what?
Everyone happened to be gay.
Wow.
because this service organization that David works for is somewhat the equivalent of, like, Strut in the Castro. So it focuses on, you know what I mean? On gay men, predominantly. Okay.
So did he put the posting out in, like, a gay space?
I think they probably put the posting at this organization because they were focusing on, again, the organization itself is the first of its kind in the UK that marries the idea of counseling, addiction counseling, and HIV counseling and STI, you know, diagnosis right. and stuff. So it was the first of its kind because usually what he was saying in the UK is there'll be like a lot of bureaucracy. If you want to get counseling for drugs, you have to go over here. If you want counseling for HIV, you have to go over here. Yeah. If you want testing, you over here. But this brought it all together, not unlike, very much like what an organization called Strut does here in the Castro District, our gay area. So I think that because they put it there, they got that. I think that also once they started to kind of hone in on what the idea that they had in mind, they wanted to probably keep the spectrum of who they spoke with kind of narrow because right. once you start adding in other factors, then things change a little bit. So,
well,
he did say that people thought that this was sensationalistic and whatever. And I was just getting ready to say, like, I think it would be really interesting to do something along this lines.
That's so about... weird to say something like that. It's a sensation.
Right.
Like, I don't know if I would ever use those words, but you know,
well, he said it, they said it was sensationalism, meaning kind of like, they made it more graphic than they needed to. They made it more, like, whatever than they needed to be just to make it look darker or harsher. And I'm like, girl,
you
don't need to do it, honey. The subject matter is dark and harsh enough. You know, it's like, I was going back to what I was originally going to say. I would be interested in seeing something like this done on the intersection between like trans women and drugs and sex work or what, you know, whatever. I don't know. I'm not saying that that's like all the thing or whatever, but there's something similar that could be here for like trans people to, or even just the idea of, there was a woman at this, on the panel who talked about the trans community has a higher rate of addiction than even the LGBT community as a whole, which has a higher rate of addiction than the heterosexual community. So it'd be really interesting and informative to see something like that. But I think that that would probably be frowned upon by a lot of people because of the fact that this film didn't paint a particularly pretty light for
gay people.
So I'm like, you know, anyway, that's wow. That.
Well, that's fabulous, girl.
I know. Wow. How uplifting, bitch. Oh, my God.
Diary, girl, I live.
I can't wait. I can't wait to go bring down people in the United Kingdom. Yes. Please invite me over to bring everybody down. No, actually, one of the reasons he said that he was really liked the way I handled the situation is because these are his words, girl. He said that I was very gentle and respectful to the audience.
Wow.
But also vulnerable in sharing my own personal experiences.
None of that sounds like Pollo.
And then when things got a little too harsh or dark, I would spruce it up with humor. It's exactly what just happened, girl. I was like, yeah. And then everybody died of AIDS. But it was a great punchline.
Oh my goodness.
Luckily, actually, nobody in the film dies of AIDS, even though like every single one of them has HIV.
Oh my goodness.
And yeah, it's intense. Oh my God. And there's this one guy in the film.
Don't ruin the whole film for these people, you Pollo. Jesus. Mm.
Go see it. You guys, I can't, there's no way I could ruin it for you because there's no way I could explain the graphic elements of it. I am going to tell you one little scene. It happens in like 1 second, but it's like so indicative of the experiences of many, many gay men I know who have had crystal meth addiction. Like fairly early in the film, this guy, the one who I said looked demonic or whatever, like he hooks up with a guy on Grindr. So the guy comes over. Meanwhile, there is a full camera crew going on, like whatever. They're shooting all of this. Like it's like, and they're, you're seeing it all. So the guy shows up and the two people are both high. The two guys are both high. The guy who just shot up is like furiously giving the one dude a blowjob. He's like really into it. He's like, just going to fucking town. And meanwhile, the dude who's getting his dick sucked is literally sitting there on Grindr as if there's nothing going on. He's not even paying attention. He's like, la la la. Girl, that is really like quite honest because so often these people have these drug encounters and half of their time is like searching for something else. They're not even actually present in the moment of what's happening. But the one guy is just sucking dick to beat the fucking band, bitch. And the other guy is just could not even be bothered. And there's a camera crew standing right there watching it all. It is dreadful.
I don't know. I can't even imagine being part of that production team, girl. I would.
Could you imagine?
No, I can't. So where can people see this?
The name of the film is Chemsex. Chemsex, obviously. It's Max Gogarty, Gogarty. Just Google it, and you'll be able to find places. I obviously it's able to be streamed from somewhere because Vibeke found it and watched it. So
okay.
If Vibeke can do it, anybody can do it. Again, thank you for watching the show, Vibeke, Jesus. And we're glad that we were able to like bring a little bit of information and clarity for you.
Well, gee, okay.
All right.
I don't know what to say after that.
Yeah, though. Neither do I. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. And when we do, we're going to talk about the latest episode of RuPaul's Drag Race. We'll be back with more Party Foul Radio right after this.
Girl. Hi, this is Shangela, and you're listening to Party Foul Radio with Pollo and Pearl, honey. All in.
Clock the bag.
Clock the bag.
Clock the shoe.
Clock the shoe.
Now punch the clock. It's time to work, 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 work.
Okay, you guys, we are back with more Party Foul Radio. I'm Pearl Delmar.
And I'm Pearl Tease. This is the moment where we hit that spoiler alert button for you.
Yeah. By the way, off the air, Pearl and I just had an intriguing conversation, which I'll just recap. I'm writing this fiction series for Huffington Post now. Well, HuffPost, my editors have told me we're just HuffPost now. They've changed it from Huffington to HuffPost.
Really?
Yeah.
Come on, HuffPost.
So, it's called Life by the Bay, and I'm up to part section 11. It's an ongoing serialized anthology series. And part 11 focuses on Rent, the musical. And I was asking Pearl if she considers Angel a drag queen or a transgender woman.
And which is really difficult, because I think I was telling her that, like, in today's society, she would definitely be considered transgendered. But from the Broadway play and from the musical, during that time period, I think she would have been considered just a drag queen. And it's, you know, it's debatable, but in the song La Vie Boheme, and in the beginning of the film, she identifies as male. I mean, well, she shows up as male, and in the song, her and her partner says, "We're brothers."
I remember that when the person asks, and she's like, "We're brothers."
Yeah, and then the lesbians say, "We're sisters."
Anyway, it's just one of those things. That'll show up. I'm going to have to... I was explaining to her that this whole story is set in 1999, or it begins in 1999, and I want to kind of reflect the thought process of people in 1999, and the terminology that was used in 1999 would not be so socially acceptable today, so right. We'll probably classify her as a drag queen, just for safety's sake. Anyway, speaking of drag queens, you guys, spoiler alert!
Here we go.
Back on track, bitches. So, on the most recent episode of RuPaul's Drag Race, it starts out with the Snatch Game, of course. Probably everybody's favorite episode of the whole season.
You know, I have to say, it's never been my favorite.
Really?
Yeah. It's never been my favorite. But you have to also realize I'm not a big fan of camp drag, and I'm not a fan
of... Yeah, Pearl's not a big fan of that.
Yeah, I'm not.
Which must be a real tough pill to swallow, because the last few seasons, they focused on these acting challenges, which are all much more campy.
Yes, girl.
Heavily focused on acting challenges. That
makes it very hard to watch sometimes.
Especially since most of those acting challenges are dreadful.
Dreadful, girl.
Dreadful.
Anyway.
So, this year, I don't know. Even the ones that kind of were standouts weren't that much of standouts to me.
You know, what I've learned from watching this damn show is... Never expect Snatch Game to be amazing, because it just isn't. It just, you know.
I mean, there were elements of it that I enjoyed, you know. Obviously, the portrayal of Liza Minnelli by Alexis Michelle. Is that right? Alexis Michelle?
Alexis Michelle. I always say Alexis Mateo, then I say Alexis Miranda, and then I say Alexis Michelle. I always forget that bitch's name.
So, Alexis Michelle did very well as Liza.
She did.
Sasha Velour as...
Oh, I don't know who that person is.
She did Marlene Dietrich. Marlene Dietrich was good.
And Nina Bonina as Jasmine Masters was kind of incredible, I thought.
Yeah, she was very funny, but this is something that they said on the judging panel, and... I would agree with, and it was actually Candace Kane who said it. Her opinion is that drag race queens who now choose other drag race queens...
Is boring.
Yeah, and I 100% agree, you guys. And the reason being is that the idea of a challenge like this is to take people who are sometimes potentially not even that hilarious or whatever and make a big spoof of them.
Yeah.
Well, when you take somebody like Alyssa Edwards, who's a huge personality, or right. Jasmine Masters, who's a huge personality, and you just basically replicate what they actually do, you're not doing anything that creative. Somebody else has done the work for you. The fact that you can channel it, maybe, as a talent or whatever, but...
But that could be said about doing any kind of impersonation.
I think it's a little bit cheating. I thought that Valentina as Miss Columbia was hilarious.
It was okay, yeah.
I mean, she took somebody... Now, girl...
She was kind of funny.
You know, she took this person who had, like, 15 minutes of fame because she was accidentally crowned Miss Universe and had the crown taken back by Steve Harvey.
Yeah.
And turned it into, like, a good comedy. That's actually quite intelligent.
Uh-huh.
So, and then they followed the Snatch Game. Oh, wait. Let's backtrack. There were some people who were painful. Girl, I love Peppermint, but her NeNe Leakes was
awful.
Dreadful.
I don't know what it is, but every time they put that camera on her when she's supposed to like have like a speaking part, she just chokes up, can't get the words out of her mouth.
Yeah.
And it just Fucked her up, girl.
Yeah, and then Pheromone was Gigi Gorgeous. That was Gigi Dreadful.
She looked the part, but girl, she just was... She was awful.
Boring as fuck. And then who was the other one that... Yeah, Sofia Vergara.
Cuckoo. Cynthia
Lee Fontaine as Cuckoo as Sofia Vergara was dreadful. Like, I can't even... It was terrible. It was terrible. So then they did...
Shea Coulee did Naomi Campbell. That was cute.
Yeah. I lived for her neck piece and everything.
Yeah, I lived for her entire look.
The whole look was great. Shea Coulee was very good. So then, you know, it kind of sucked because I think Alexis Michelle would have been even better if she'd gotten to do Kris Jenner again, girl, because she, like, that would have been hilarious.
Right.
So then they had Night of a Thousand Madonnas Part 2.
Again, girl. And how about two girls... Two sets of girls, so four girls came out in the same outfit. Well, it was two and two.
Two and two, same outfit. And that is something that's beyond me. Madonna has, like, hundreds of signature looks. Hundreds.
What is your favorite look?
My favorite Madonna look would be... I don't understand. They have not yet had one person do the iconic Like a Virgin look, which mm-hmm. is, like, the... You know, like the wedding dress kind of thing with the belt.
So my partner asked me what's my favorite one, and that's my favorite one. That's what I would have worn.
That's what I would have done too, probably. Or
can you guys imagine if me and Poya would have worn the same Madonna look?
Yeah, that would have been very interesting.
I would have lived.
You know, that's one of my favorite looks. I was pleased that a couple of girls, two girls, also did the Material Girl look. Uh-huh. That's another iconic look. I mean, you just have to think though. Madonna has. So many iconic looks.
Even if I didn't do that one, I probably would have did Madonna from Die Another Day.
I mean, there's like...
There's so many.
There are so many, and then these girls show up and they... Whatever. The person who on the runway... Like, they loved Alexis Michelle as Breathless Mahoney, Madonna, uh-huh. from Dick Tracy. And spoiler alert, Alexis ends up winning the challenge.
Girl, I think they gave it to her just to shut her the fuck up.
Well, sometimes, girl. I don't know about that, because sometimes I think that they will not give a girl a win just to keep her bitching, because it makes better TV, but...
Girl.
But the person
they should have did it then, because, girl, I would have loved to see how irate her ass would have been if they didn't give it to her.
I think a very, very, very close second was Valentina again, because Valentina came out, you guys, as Madonna from the Sex Book with... It was so simple.
It was just clever.
Two big black strips across her cooch... And across her breasts, and she was, like, blonde and hitchhiking. Uh-huh. So she was from the Sex Book. But I thought it was fucking brilliant. Because you have
to... clever.
Yeah, it's very clever. It was very intelligent. It was a very, very intelligent Madonna look.
Yeah.
Anyway, ultimately, spoiler alert, once... This is the third time, you guys. No more for you. Ultimately, the bottom two end up being Peppermint and Cuckoo, Cynthia Lee Fontaine.
Peppermint wore her out.
Yeah. Peppermint, girl.
Wore her out.
It could be summed up. They lip-synced to Madonna's music, and it could be summed up in one hand motion. There's a part where she, like, literally was, shooting hand gestures, shooting
right.
Cynthia Lee Fontaine, and as that bitch, she just went down in flames. You shot her right down. So she sent her packing with her cuckoo. Two seasons, still no victory for Cynthia Lee Fontaine. Poor thing. So...
Right.
girl, Pheromone, I think, is probably the next to go, because she's, like...
Her outfit, though, was apparently, like, spot on to what the actual thing was, the actual look was.
Yeah, well, all I can say is she better be grateful that she had a good Madonna outfit.
Right.
And didn't double up somebody's look, because, you know, Peppermint had a doubled up look, and the funny thing was, her Madonna Material Girl look... looked about 100 times better than the other Madonna Material Girl look.
Mm-hmm.
Girl, she had on that mid-length gown, three-quarter-length gown, and as soon as that music started, she was like, let me raise this right up. She's like, I know it's gonna look ugly as fuck, all its satininess, but right. I'm gonna wear this bitch out.
It was funny. It was great. I loved it. Did you see Untucked?
No, girl! I see this every damn week.
Your homework is to watch all the goddamn Untucked.
Okay, so what happened on Untucked?
Untucked this time, Pheromone was sure it was going to be her.
In the bottom?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, luckily, like I said,
right,
because her ass would have been sent right home.
Right. And it was just really sad to see kind of Cynthia go home, even though it was just her time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just her time.
I honestly, you guys, because...
I think next is between Farrah and Aja. They both can go home.
I actually thought that based on the way the show is usually structured, when somebody's storyline sort of plays out or comes out...
Peppermint just came out.
Uh-huh. Like, they often will be sent home because, right. Well, they've done their reveal. Mm-hmm. They gotta go. And Peppermint came out as transgender. You know, all the girls hugged her and she was accepted and embraced. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, she's going home. But, bitch, oh no, ma'am. That right. Lip sync was
another
just
thing that
on
happened
point.
In the Untucked is Nina Bonina's mother sent in a video that they all got to see, and that part was lovely too. And Shea Coulee had some words with her to encourage her. It was good. It was a good Untucked. It was a very uplifting but kind of sad. It was good.
Well, Nina Bonina Brown, I still find her highly creative. I'm still trying to get over her victimhood situation. Mm-hmm. That only goes so far with me, and it wears me out. But she needs to be careful, because if she goes back to that place, the judges have already said there's some serious red flags here, girl. They're going to just be like, you know what? We're done with you. Like, yeah. You're fun and interesting and creative, but you got to go.
We'll see. I think, I don't know who's going to, who do you think is going to be in the top three? It's so hard to say.
It is kind of hard to say. My guess at this point for top three would be Shay, Trinity or Alexis, and Sasha Velour for some reason.
I could see Sasha in the top three. I think it's going to be Shay, Nina, and Trinity. I think Nina might be able to redeem herself, and if she doesn't, then definitely Sasha.
I don't know. We'll have to see, but like I could see. Yeah, like I'm standing by those four. Any exchangeable number of those four, like Trinity, Sasha, Shay, and Alexis. So
yeah, I really like Shay.
I like Shay too. I like Shay.
I feel like I would be friends with her.
Yeah. Except her podcast friends are shady as fuck.
Yes.
So anyway,
yeah.
But that's an aside. Oh, girl. How about after last episode, I posted it. First thing I wake up to is Sable Jones. Ooh, girl, nothing like Poyo reading a bitch to wake you up at first thing in the morning.
I love it.
And shout out to my drag sister, Euphoria, Peter Griggs, our Grand Duke of San Francisco. He is a big fan of Andy Bell, and he listened to our podcast last, the most recent one, and was very complimentary about the interaction. He said that he's listened to a number of interviews with Andy, and he felt like Andy was more comfortable talking to me. And I said, well, I think that's because the only time we've ever met in person, we've talked many times, but the only time we've ever met in person, I was in drag. So I think it sort of like kind of makes it a more easy rapport or something. You know what I mean? They don't think of you quite the same way.
Huh.
So anyway, but Peter, I appreciate you listening and thank you for the compliments. So next week, I don't even remember what next week's challenge is on Drag Race. Do they hint at it?
I don't think so. Oh, wait, they did, but girl, I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's not like, they're not making a big deal of it like they did Kardashian the musical. Dreadful? Wretch? Girl, it was Wretch. But I am really glad that, oh, did you see this thing on Reddit where people are starting to read RuPaul's makeup?
I found out what it was, so.
Oh, I knew what it was, but I was sworn to secrecy.
The makeup artist, I think he quit during the second episode.
Matthew Anderson quit. I think during the first episode. So I had gotten an inside scoop a while ago, and I hinted at this on the air, you guys, to you, but I had been sworn to secrecy by, it's so far long ago, you guys, well, I told you originally who it was who swore me to secrecy, but you know he's going to go back and find it. But I was sworn to secrecy by someone, and it was a huge blowout between RuPaul and Matthew Anderson on the set.
Oh.
And it was ugly. There was a lot of screaming and yelling and...
About makeup?
About whatever was going on. Like, and he stormed off the set. And it's on, somebody reported on Reddit a lot of true details. There's some details that spice it up. Like, one rumor was that RuPaul said that she didn't like some hair he had done, and he went over and dunked it in the sink and then came back and slapped it on her head soaking wet.
Oh my god.
He's like, how do you like it now? And just left.
But, I don't believe
it. I don't believe that one either, but could you imagine? She's just sitting there.
She would slap somebody, girl.
She'd be like, oh! Just dripping wet with some big-ass wig.
I don't see that happening.
But the people, so they were left in the lurch for, I think, one episode. There's the rumor is that she wasn't in drag for the first episode at the end because of the fact that she didn't have a makeup artist or a wig stylist.
I don't even remember her not being in drag at the end.
Because she was a boy on the panel with Lady Gaga and stuff.
Oh my goodness.
And then they called them back for the second part or whatever. And then, like, for the second episode, she was in drag. But, which may have been why they made that shit a two-part series, because right. They're like, well, we got kind of fucked right now, so. But they brought in, ultimately, Raven took over doing Rue's makeup, and Delta Work took over doing Rue's hair. So, that's what's been going on, but it's a noticeable change in her appearance. I mean, you know, you've got this incredible makeup artist like Raven doing her face, but Matthew Anderson has literally been doing RuPaul's makeup most of her public career. And of course, he used to do like Tyra Banks's makeup, and that's why RuPaul often looked like Tyra Banks. He would just do the makeup on her, you know? And so it's very different, and people are commenting quite a lot that we don't get any close-ups of RuPaul's face. You know, they were saying that even her body shape was off because somebody did all that
for her. I don't know, girl.
And isn't it a little bit ironic that a person who's like up there judging these other bitches for all this stuff doesn't do
her?
Girl, I wouldn't either, honey, though. That's the thing. Right. Like, if I had the ability and the time and the wealth and whatever, I would.
Not that, no.
I would have somebody styling
that,
me
that
top
needs to
be bottom.
Part of my contract, girl.
Yes, absolutely. All right, you guys, that is our recap of RuPaul's Drag Race. When we come back, we're going to get a recap of RuPaul's Drag Con from Robin Slonina. She's one of our favorites. She's on Skin Wars with Miss RuPaul herself, honey.
All right.
And she will catch us up on all the goings on at RuPaul's Drag Con, where she was all this past weekend. And then later in the show, we will have DJ Cassidy on talking about his new single, Honor, and his past career, what's going on in the future, and much more. So, until then, we're going to go to a quick break. I'm Poet Elmar.
And I'm Pearl Teeth.
We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, this is Sister Roma, the most photographed nun in the world. You're listening to my good girlfriends, Polo Del Mar and Pearl Teeth. It's P-O-L-L-O. Oh, okay. Hi, this is Sister Roma, the most photographed nun in the world. You're listening to my good girlfriends, Pollo Del Mar and Pearl Tees on Party Foul Radio, Podmatic's number one LGBT podcast.
All right, you guys, we are back with more Party Foul Radio. I'm Pollo Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Tees.
And we are excited to have with us, as we promised you, a friend of the podcast, as well as one of the judges on TV Skin Wars, Miss Robin Slonina. Hey, Robin.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Fabulous.
How was DragCon?
It's good to be back.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you back. So, how was DragCon?
DragCon was amazing. I literally, speaking of being back, I just got back. I drove from L.A. to Vegas today, and I got home about an hour ago. So, I had enough time to, like, unload my suitcases, take a bath, and now I'm literally wearing, like, bunny slippers and silk pajamas because, you know, it's a podcast, so I can do that.
Yeah, exactly. So,
what are you wearing, by the way? What do you wear when you're doing this?
Oh, girl, I usually come to Poyo's house straight from work, so I'm usually in work attire.
Yep, dressed like a prostitute.
Okay.
Girl, she wishes.
And I'm wearing...
Poyo is wearing her... something she's probably had on all week.
I'm wearing an In the Heights t-shirt from the Broadway musical In the Heights and a pair of multicolor, multi-animal print yoga pants, which are...
awful.
they, well, let's just say they're very eye-catching, and I certainly get plenty of not-so appreciative attention when I'm wearing them, and I don't care.
So, wow, so you guys are like comfy hot.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not, but...
Pearl's breasts are like staring at me. She's got a very low cut top on this
week. I'm wearing a tank top. Anyway, Robin Slonina, girl.
So
what did you do out at DragCon? Did you host a panel or did you just go to kick it?
I went and I had a booth for the very first time. We had a booth with me and some of the contestants. So it was me and Angela Renee Roberts and Michael Mejia.
Awesome.
And next year we're going to come back bigger and better, and I'm going to try to talk Kyle Best and Avi Ram into coming, because we need those boys there too. It was so much fun, and I don't think like all these Skin Wars fools know what they're missing, and we all need to be there to represent, because it is a good time.
So I follow Michael Mejia
on a panel too. But I interrupted you, girl. What were you about to say?
I was just wondering if Michael was in drag, because I know he's been dressed up a few times.
Michael just pretty much, for whatever occasion, tries to wear the least amount of clothing that he can get away with.
Of course.
So, he wore a pair of, like, kind of sequin panties with this, like, sort of shoulder strap hood matching sequin ensemble. That was pretty spectacular. So basically naked.
I think he is so adorable. I'm trying to get him to come to San Francisco so I can get him in bed. Like,
man.
Oh,
Michael.
Nice.
Come on, Michael.
He's marrying somebody.
He's marrying somebody?
Well, no. Last time he was on.
Kiara. He said he was going to marry Kiara D'Alessandro. So.
Oh, well, he seems extremely single now, because every maybe 15 minutes, he had a new boyfriend at DragCon. So he kept walking up, you know, hand in hand with some new sailor and saying, "Hi, this is my boyfriend." And I'm like, "Wait, you just had another boyfriend like 20 minutes ago. Who's this guy?" So it was pretty funny.
Yeah, I've already pegged him for that kind of guy. That's why I'm not giving it up until he comes to town and asks for it.
Whatever.
Right? He kind of, like, scandalized my lovely assistant, Raina, who was helping me out all weekend long. He kind of scandalized her by actually, like, just making out with someone in front of the booth. And she was like, "Oh, my goodness." So, it was a fun time. He was eye candy and entertaining for all of us.
Yeah, I'm sure of it.
So tell us about this panel.
Yeah, tell us about your panel.
Oh, the panel was awesome. The panel was, I was the moderator, and it was sort of just a creative body painting, you know, meets makeup, meets drag kind of panel, and it was me and Manila Luzon, and it was Nina Bonina Brown from this current season of Drag Race, and she is so creative, and she does all those kind of paper pieces that she then paints and then paints herself to match. And then it was Michael Mejia, Angela Renee Roberts, and Angela brought her model with her up to the panel. And then it was me. So it was really a lot of fun. And, you know, I got to know Nina Bonina a little bit more. And, you know, she's new to this kind of level of exposure and all that stuff. And, you know, she still describes herself as like a cheap ass queen that like makes things out of paper. And she had this amazing eyeball on her forehead, which in her forehead that was actually like, you know, it had some structure to it. It was like a puffy eyeball, and she made it out of Play-Doh and glued it to her forehead.
Incredible.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah, so she does everything, you know, on a dime. And so I'm really excited, because I think she's one to watch, because suddenly I think she's going to have more and more budget coming to her that she can really work with and play with. And I'm excited to see what she's doing when it's not just, you know, cardboard and paper and Play-Doh, because she's so creative. It's going to be cool to watch her continue to evolve.
Yeah, she's somebody that I have said from the start of this season that I really find interesting and inspiring, because of the fact that she has the ability to do glamour drag, for example, but she doesn't relegate herself to that. And that has been, you know, as you know, we've had conversations like that's been one of my goals too, is to like kind of push myself. It has been to like push myself and step outside of the comfort zone, because I think we get really locked in comfort zones, you know what I mean? And to try something new is scary to sometimes if you've been doing something successfully for a while.
Yeah, and you know what was interesting? You know, there's so much to look at and so much eye candy, so much to think about, you know, as you're watching all these artists, you know, careers evolve. Like, I saw Trixie Mattel there, and she's just huge. And if you think about her, you know, on Drag Race, I mean, you guys probably are more experts than I am, but I don't think she went really that far, you know, in the competition because she's known for one very strong look. And I know to succeed on Drag Race, you got to have that variety. But what's so funny about it is that the fans and other artists and queens really responded to that one strong look. And now she's just like as big as all of them. I mean, hours of people waiting in line to see her. And now you see, you know, other queens like really taking on that look and also kind of making it their own and being inspired by her. So, you know, it's just so interesting how everybody kind of handles that exposure that something like Drag Race gives them, and then how they run with it, you know. And do they do things all different? Do they keep one signature look that they just keep building on, or do they constantly transform themselves? It's just, I mean, they're really artists. I think that more and more I just really appreciate that drag queens are artists, and their canvas is their face, and their canvas is their wardrobe, and they just, it's astounding to see it all in person, because it's just like, it's like looking at a bunch of frosted cakes walking around. It's just delicious.
Yeah, I think that it, one of the things that I've actually never, Pearl or I have never been to DragCon, but I just know that everybody kind of goes there and goes all out for the experience, right. And it's like, you know, I just think that for me, I would almost want to go and not be in drag just so I could sort of like examine everybody else and see what everybody else is doing. You know what I mean? Like really get up in their business, because I get really inspired by those things.
Yeah. And you can do both. You know, it's 2 days. So I think this is just from pictures. So I'm not sure because I didn't get to see her in person, but I think that Ginger Minj went, you know, one day as a boy and then she went the next day in drag. I could be wrong about this, but I think I saw Instagram pictures where she did like one day on, one day off. And I know some people do that too. So because it's a lot of work, man, getting all ready and dressed, and then, you know, and then you're in uncomfortable shoes and attire the whole day, and you got lashes on and all that, you know. And then there's after parties and, you know, official events and fashion shows that you can go to afterwards. And then you got to get up again the next morning and do it all again. Like, it's a lot. I don't think many people sleep much during DragCon.
Wow. One of the things...
I think they were also having the Drag Queens of Comedy the same weekend out there.
I think so. I think Drag Queens of Comedy...
So they did. I didn't do any of that. And I, you know, I could have probably tried to, you know, milk some tickets out of my boy Rue, but I was just like, I can't do this, because I needed to be fresh, I needed to be awake. It's a lot of work, and I just wanted to focus on the hours that I was, you know, required to be there and be, you know, awake for my panel. And I'm leaving all that staying up all night to the young queens, because I'm too old for that shit.
Now, speaking of Rue and your relationship, when does Skin Wars return?
Ooh, that is the million-dollar question. Officially, I think all I can say is, you know, call the network and ask them.
Oh.
I mean, we still have our fingers crossed for a season 4, but a lot of time has elapsed. And so I would say, you know, if fans want the show, reach out and let them know, because I know we're all ready to go. We want to do it. And I have my fingers crossed for season 4.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I will say that my three, well, you know, besides Drag Race, Face Off on Sci-Fi Network and Skin Wars are two of my favorite places to find inspiration for my drag. And now, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's this new show called Cosplay Melee.
So
I heard you talking about it because I just listened to your last podcast. And I thought, but then after I heard you talk about it, I'm like, oh no, I have to check it out. I got to find out those tips and tricks that you were talking about because that's useful.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's the crazy thing. You know, you were talking about, you know, Nina Bonita Brown making these costumes kind of like on a dime and stuff. And you get to see the insider tricks of professional, you don't really think about it as professional cosplayers, but they, right, for all intents and purposes, are. And, you know, one of the things that they make very clear as contestants on the show is that they are struggling artists. You know, they all have real jobs that pay the bills, but this is what they want to do in their part time. So they show you how to make whatever. They, you know, they paint stuff that makes it look like real metal, and they do all of these highlights and lowlights. So it's a lot of painting elements to, and it, and, you know, it's very interesting to see. And the way they make.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out.
Definitely.
And, you know, Skinwars is one of my favorite shows too. Like, I would say my top favorite shows, as far as like competition shows, are all the ones that are skill based. Because, you know, a show like Skinwars, a show like Face Off or Project Runway, you don't necessarily need to fabricate drama, because the drama is just inherent to the competition. And so I think those shows feel much more real. And I can tell you, you know, firsthand that we don't mess with anything on Skin Wars. If there is drama, it happens organically. And, you know, I love it also because I think people think a lot of times reality TV, you know, you're famous for nothing. But, like, people on Drag Race, people on these other shows I mentioned, they're there because they actually have talent, and they are talented, and they do deserve, you know, their moment to shine, and to show the world what they can do, because, you know, these are shows that really showcase artists, and I think that's what I love about my top shows.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of shows on TV today that people legitimately are famous for kind of doing nothing, and that's very frustrating,
right?
Because, you know, when you think about people who've got legitimate talent of some kind, and they're just trying to have the opportunity to earn a living doing what they love or showcase that, and then you get somebody who has no redeemable talent or qualities whatsoever, and they're wildly famous, you're just like, really? Really? You know?
Yeah,
I know. Famous for being famous.
But, yeah, and one of the things I think that ideally Drag Race is kind of learning from that, because I think in the past they've done some things that might have manipulated drama or enhanced drama. And I'm like, you've got 14 drag queens in a room. You don't need to do anything to have drama.
Right.
It's going to happen.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, sequestering them. I mean, I have heard, I think it's better now, but I think early on, you know, they were in hotel rooms and they were very isolated, and that can make you go a little crazy if you're a very social person. And then, you know, queens like Lagonda, you know, she didn't have access to her medication because, you know, the laws were different back then. And so for her, you know, that was very stressful to be on a show completely stone sober every day. She wasn't used to that. You know, that is something that she has for anxiety and all kinds of other things. And so, you know, I think those things created drama. It's just like the nature of the beast. If you're sequestered and cut off from family and friends and spending a lot of time, you know, alone, and then you're on the show, and then you're alone again, then you're on the show. You know, I think that is stressful, and that also causes stress. And just lack of sleep. I mean, there's always going to be lack of sleep on these shows. Like, sometimes in Skin Wars, we'd have 16-hour days. I think had 18-hour day once. You know, I mean, by season three, things were running more smoothly, and we didn't have such crazy long days. But, you know, while we were still kind of getting our sea legs that first season, like, there was some long days, and we were awake, and the contestants were awake, and so it's rough. But, you know, I just try to tell the artists, look at it like an arts residency, and, you know, the fact that you're cut off from Facebook and your friends, and just think about it as this is your time to focus on your art, and that you're going to live and breathe your art right now, and let this be like an arts residency, and think of it like that. You know, think of what you're gaining and not what you're losing, and make the most of this opportunity, because you guys are going to walk out of here way better artists than you walked in. It's like a master class, you know, in body painting. You're going to learn from each other. You're going to learn from us. So, you know, it's also just like you have to have the right attitude if you're going to do a show like this.
Yeah, I mean, I watched, I don't know if you ever watched Face Off, which I also...
Yes, I love Face Off.
Obsessed. And I just watched the Face Off All-Stars season, and one of the things I loved about it was... There, of course, there's drama every episode, like, you know, somebody's mold would stick or, like, they'd break something or whatever. But the thing was, no, like, everybody was super helpful to each other. Everybody was super nice. And there was something really special about watching people who had returned to this environment and actually liked each other. Everybody liked each other and everybody...
And you know what that is? It's just Pollo not being used to people liking her, girl.
Oh, God.
I'm used to seeing that girl.
She's so shady. She's so shady.
You know, on Face Off, like, before every commercial break, it's like, oh, my mold won't open. And then you're like, okay, I've seen season after season. It always opens.
True story.
You know it's going to open. They always leave it like a cliffhanger, like as if we've never seen the show before. And I think maybe in, like, what are they on, like, 11 seasons? Or maybe, like...
Not open once or something like for real. So yeah, it's just like really, I mean, I don't think that's a cliffhanger. We know it's gonna open because like three people are gonna come help you, and you know, it, that camaraderie, that really does touch me too. I, everyone does seem nice and helpful, and I think that's the artist community. You know, artists do tend to help each other. Yeah, I have to say that I loved, like, you know, we, when it got to the finale of Face Off, or finale of Face Off,
I
was like legitimately torn because through the storyline, you know, just watching it play out, you got two guys in there who are best friends. You got this other woman who's super talented and she gets reunited finally in the finale with her, you know, incredible partner that she'd been teamed up with. And it was like just really good. It was like everybody's fantastic and you get to appreciate the drama becomes that everyone is wildly talented and you're just waiting to see who kind of like pulls out into the lead at the last second, you know? And that's high drama. It's good. Yeah. It's good TV. Yeah. It doesn't, you don't have to have villains and you don't have to have people hating each other and being awful. And I was like, I just loved it. I didn't miss an episode. So.
Yeah. And everyone was legitimately happy for the winner. And I know a lot of those Face-Off cats just from going to Monsterpalooza every year. So there's this another really fun convention called Monsterpalooza and Son of Monsterpalooza, and it's all things monsters and practical effects and, you know, special effects and makeup, and it's so much fun. And I actually did see some, like, spillover. Like, there's Frankenstein, I think he called himself, like this very glamorous Frankenstein that was at both events. I saw her at DragCon, and then I saw her at Monsterpalooza. So, you know, there is some a lot of crossover with that kind of extreme makeup. But my son and I go every year, and I kind of make it all about him. I paint him. I dress him up in costumes because, you know, he loves the attention, and he has so much fun just playing a character the whole weekend. And we've met Sig Neutron there, and, man, he could not have been nicer to my kid. And, you know, we sort of became friends a little bit just through that. And then we saw each other again this past Monsterpalooza. And then I invited him to come to Vegas and, you know, maybe do some special effects demo at my body painting studio at Second City. So we'll see if he's going to come down. But it's just a really nice guy. But very friendly. And, yeah, we hit it off really well. You can see a lot of those Face-Off cats if you go to Monsterpalooza, and they're super approachable. Everyone's really nice, and that's, like, a great way to go fan out. If people love Face-Off, go to Monsterpalooza.
I mean, Sig definitely, like, just earned that win at the last second. So, you know, like, I didn't like some of his stuff as well, but that last finale, he deserved the win. So congratulations.
Oh, that dragon was really good.
Oh my God. The dragon and the tiger both were like individually, either one was better than everybody else's material. And then together they were just iconic. It was so good.
Yeah. So good. Oh, and speaking of iconic, I really wanted to get some of your makeup looks on my panel.
I know.
At DragCon, oh girl, I can't even tell you. Well, first of all, I guess I should have known that I was moderating, but somehow that kind of just slipped through the cracks. And last time, you know, Skin Wars had this big booth, and the network, you know, sponsored everything, and they're like, hey, you're going to be on a panel, and I'm like, okay, cool. So I just prepared my own section of what I was going to talk about on the panel and everything, and then this year they're like, hey, you know, you want to be on a panel, and I'm like, yeah, yeah, you want to do a panel? I'm like, sure. So then, like, finally it comes down, like, few weeks before DryCon, like, okay, so do you have the outline for the panel that you're moderating? And I was like, ooh, moderating. Ooh, that's the word that I missed in this whole conversation. Okay, I better jump up and start moderating. So I'm like, okay, so I gotta get in touch with everybody, and I don't have all their contact info, so, you know, DryCon people, can you please set up a group email so I can find out what people want to present and get an outline together and, you know, get their bios, get their pictures, you know, and then, you know, I'm going to do something really audiovisual because this is, you know, a very audiovisual type of art form. Like, you got to be able to see it. We're talking about art and body paint. And so I'm collecting, like, you know, 10 high-res images from everybody, and then I'm putting them in order so there's, like, no mistake when we give it to the AV person. And then I did this presentation of my own where I was really talking about how drag queens and body painters should team up because it's just like a match made in heaven. We can create so much cool art together. And then I addressed the issue that I've heard from a lot of queens of, like, they don't want to get naked. They don't want to be exposed like that because so much of your art form is like what you cinch, what you pad, you know, what you hide, what you show. And
totally.
So that just, like, total exposure is, like, really intimidating to people. So I kind of addressed all that and said, you know, the same way that you can use clothing to sort of hide and cinch, you can do that with paint. And I had all these examples of, like, you know, a black backdrop and then a person standing in front of it where the sides, the black sides of your dress are kind of cut in that give you this hourglass figure. And so you can do stuff like that. You can do it artfully. You can do something where someone basically is like turning into a bunch of butterflies at the bottom of their body. So you can't even, you know, their actual body shape is sort of hidden. And then you can do kind of tongue-in-cheek camouflage things. Like, there's a very famous picture by Joanne Gare where a woman is laying down on a deck chair in this skimpy little bikini, and when you look closely, you realize that the fabric of the deck chair has been painted on, like, a good portion of her body, which, like, basically shaved off, like, 100 pounds off of her side. And so that's very kind of comical way. And then kind of the final thing that I was part of my presentation was, like, or, you know, just rock what you got and don't worry about it and put yourself out there to be a positive role model in, like, radical body acceptance. And then I had a bunch of examples of, like, beautiful, like, 350-pound cheetah, you know, just, like, gorgeous, very large woman with, like, graffiti paint on her back, or, you know, tons of examples of people just really, really thin and, you know, but then being painted with this, like, gorgeous kind of ghoulish makeup that really made the most of their body type. And, you know, just, like, why not just rock what you have and be an example of, like, really accepting yourself. And then I also had you in there as, like, okay, here's some examples of, you know, queens that have been influenced by body paint, Skin Wars and painting. And so, oh, I stayed up all night, probably two or three nights in a row. Like, I maybe got, like, 2 hours sleep here. I put together this rocking presentation. I timed myself. I was like, it was all ready to go. And then the day before DragCon, they contacted me. They're like, we are so sorry. We don't have audio visual for your room. Like, we just can't make it work.
Oh, my God.
We tried everything. They have nothing. They're like, there's nothing. Like, you're going to have to do a presentation with no picture. We can't rent anything. It's, you know, a union convention hall. We can't change the time. We can't change the date. Like, this poor guy that was organizing is like, there's nothing I can do. I've been trying to troubleshoot and problem solve this all day, and I don't know what to tell you. There's not going to be any pictures. So,
how, like, rude.
Okay. And, you know, you never want to be that person. I'm sure they're dealing with, like, a lot of divas, and I'm just like, you don't want to be that person that's like, outrageous. I refuse to go on, you know? So I'm like, what are we going to do? And so basically what they decided to do is they printed a few pictures really big and brought them in on, like, an easel. Like, you know, like an old, like, Bonzo
right.
show where you, like, flip the images, like, off an easel kind of thing.
Oh, my God.
So that's, like, that's the best we can do. But, you know, printing big images, like, that's expensive, too, and it's, like, a day away. So they're, like, we can, I begged, and I got a budget to do 12 large-scale, like, 36-inch images for you. So then I had to go back to all the queens that I had already been having trouble getting their pictures, getting their bios, getting all of that stuff, and then be like, so sorry, plan B, you know, 24 hours notice, now I need to know what are your best two pictures, because, you know, try to explain all this, and it was so confusing, and but we all just rolled with it, and everybody was just such a good sport, they all just, like, rolled with it, and then they printed these pictures, and then they said, one of the drag con helpers down and walked like Vanna White, like holding the pictures down the aisle because it was packed. Like they were standing room only, so they walked the pictures down and it was funny, you know, and we made it work. We definitely made it work, but there wasn't, your pictures didn't make it because there just wasn't enough image. They wouldn't let us have enough pictures.
Well,
I'm sorry, Pollo.
Next time. There'll be a next time for you, Pollo Del Mar.
That's the way the cookie crumbles.
You know what? I think your pictures are waiting for you to be in that audience and stand up and take a bow when they get shown.
Exactly.
So it just all means that you need to come to DragCon.
Yes, that is possibly true, Robin. So, is Leo there? We want to talk. You guys, we want to talk to Robin's son, Leo. She's like, you want to talk to my friends?
I have a 7-year-old son named Leo, and he is very artistic, although I think more of a performer. Like, that's kind of his thing. He really likes to do theater and dress up and wear costumes and makeup. You want to talk to my friends? Okay, here we go. I'm going to put you on. Okay, say hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Leo.
Hi.
What's going on?
Usually just playing on my iPad and watching videos how to make a baby.
Yeah, we made a deal that I could do this podcast and give him some screen time so that he could be quiet while I did it.
You're making me cold.
Oh, sorry.
Making me hot.
Yeah, she's interrupting your... Okay. Leo, she's interrupting your interview time. You need to tell her that she's already had her opportunity. So, Leo, what's it like to have a mom that's on TV?
It's awesome.
Yeah? What's the best part about it?
It feels a little bit weird, too.
It's weird, too? Why is that?
It's because I am... It's kind of weird because it's like... My mom is, like, famous.
Yeah?
Yeah.
In a weird way.
What happened when we went roller skating?
People started taking pictures with my mom.
Oh, because...
Yeah, when we go places, we sometimes have our fun interrupted a little bit. Like, even at the local roller rink, or when we went to Disneyland, people kind of want to...
Lamp? Yeah, you said Disney lamp.
I said Disney lamp. So when we went to Disney lamp... just kidding. Disneyland, people kind of want to stop and take pictures and stuff like that. So that can be a little weird, but Leo's usually very nice about it.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah, but well, it's got to be cool having a mom who's an artist, too, because she can help you make, turn yourself into a character or paint you like a lion or whatever you wanted to be, right?
Yeah.
What's
your favorite characters that I've done for you?
A burnt Boy Scout and marionette.
Yes.
Oh, she...
I turn him into a living marionette where I have, like, strings tied to, like, this marionette holder, and then he acts like a doll, and it's so creepy and fun, and we get a lot of attention for it, and then sometimes people, like, at Monster Cruise will stop and want to take a bunch of pictures, and then he'll kind of elbow me and be like, Mom, do the bit. And then I'm supposed to, like, point somewhere and accidentally let go of the marionette holder, and then he
so cool.
It's so funny.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a perfect pairing, an artist mom and an artistic child.
Yes, she's definitely a ham, so that helps.
Well, well, that is great. Do you think, what do you want to be when you get older, Leo?
An astronaut.
An astronaut?
All right.
Because I know a lot of math.
Okay.
Yeah, ironically, he's also good at math. So,
I'm good at multiplication. I'm good at multiplication, and I'm even in first grade.
All right.
Well, there you have it. Well, Robin and Leo, we're so glad you called.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, it is to talk to you as well.
Girl, remind our listeners where they can follow everything that you're doing on social media.
Okay, yes. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Robin Slonina. It is RobinSlonina. And also, one thing I also wanted to mention is that I took the opportunity at DragCon to market this Love is Love t-shirt. And it's a body paint design that I did of a pride flag embracing an American flag. And I made this shirt for a cause, and the proceeds go to help this group called The Center here in Las Vegas. And they provide all kinds of counseling and shelter and free immunizations and free STD testing and job training and all kinds of stuff like that for LGBTQ youth here in Vegas.
Oh, that amazing. Sounds wonderful.
Amazing.
Yeah, so you can find those on my website, robinslonina.com, and there's a whole shopping page. And a lot of people, I think, don't realize that Vegas has a pretty big homeless LGBT youth population because, unfortunately, a lot of people get rejected by their religious families in Utah, and the closest and cheapest bus ticket from Salt Lake City is Las Vegas.
Wow.
So we end up with a lot of kids here that are dealing with some heavy stuff, being rejected by their families and having identity crisis. And this organization is really great about helping out those people and getting them back on their feet and getting them counseling and training. They have a whole computer center. They have the first LGBTQ library in the state. And they just do such great work. They've been around since 1992, and I've been aware of them and helping with fundraisers and stuff for about 10 years. And just can't say enough good stuff about it. So I'm like, well, if I'm going to sell some merch at DragCon, I might as well try to do it for a good cause. So check out my Love is Love t-shirt and support a great cause here in Vegas.
Aw, thank you, Robin, for doing that, and thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. I love you guys. I'm going to see you at DragCon next year.
Okay.
For sure.
If not before, then somewhere. Bye, Robin.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. You guys, you need to go online, get on Twitter or whatever, and hit up the Game Show Network and have them bring back Skin Wars, because I love that show.
That would be amazing, girl.
Yeah. I mean, come on now. It's like, it was it's such a great show, so... All right, you guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to have DJ Cassidy on with us talking about his new music and a new single, Honor. You're listening to Party Foul Radio. I'm Poet Omar.
And I'm Pearl T.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm just really glad that we got a chance to talk today. So,
yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem at all. Of course, I wanted to start off just by talking about Honor, because it's like a real slow burn to me, and it's one of those things that the more I listen to it, the more I absolutely love it.
I'm happy that you're enjoying it.
Yeah, it is a great track. It's one of those things where I think that the appeal grows over time versus other songs that might hit right out of the gate and then wear off really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, there's there's benefits to both. As long as you're feeling it, I'm happy.
One of the things I read in an interview you guys did with promoting the song with Billboard magazine, and you talked about wanting Lil Yachty on the track, and I think that the style of song, and I think that his performance is something that some of his more hardcore fans probably wouldn't expect from him, and I was wondering if you could talk about kind of eliciting that from him.
Well, maybe I should tell you a bit first about how Grace came onto the record, which kind of leads into Yachty.
Let's go. Let's do it.
I'm always in the studio with songwriters, you know, recording songs to music that I have created with my production partner, whose name is Greg Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. And I had this one track in particular that I found that was special. Every now and then you get a track that just brings the best out of every songwriter. You know, sometimes you'll play a track for someone and it might take a minute for something to come, and then you'll play for someone else and it might take a minute, and then it's a process to kind of find the lightning to strike. But then once in a while you get a track that just kind of elicits something special out of everyone's mouth, and this track was doing that. So I had recorded several different songs to this music, with several different writers, all that were great. And then I ended up in a studio with this young songwriter who I'd never met, named Whitney Phillips. And we were introduced by our publisher, because we're signed to the same publishing company, BMG. And she started humming a little something, and I could see her mulling it over, and she had an idea, but it wasn't flowing quite as fluidly as we'd like. And I opened up the session to the song, not just the instrumental, but the session. And I muted half of the orchestration. I'm known for these very musical and very elaborate orchestrations, live string sections, live horn sections. You know, I often recruit the legendary musicians of the late 70s and early 80s. And I went into the session and I muted half the orchestration. And what it did was it opened up everything. Not only did it open up the track from a musical standpoint, but it opened up the entire room from a vibe standpoint. And it changed her level of inspiration. And from that point, she just spit out the song. And she's telling a story that's been told a million times. When I was in Shakespeare class in high school, the teacher used to say, Shakespeare's stories are not unique. They were nothing new. It was the way he told them that was unique.
I was actually talking about something similar to that yesterday with a friend, and I said, you can ask 50 people to tell the same story, and you're going to get 50 different stories about the same subject.
Exactly. You know, Shakespeare told basic stories about love and jealousy, but told them better than any writer had ever told them before. Whitney told a story that's been told a million times. Girl's in a relationship with a guy, girl wants more from the guy, guy wants back in. The story's been told a million times. She told it in such a unique way, and she told it with such poetry that it made the story unique. So the songwriter Whitney sang it with such conviction, and she has such a great voice and such a unique voice that it was hard to think of someone singing it as powerfully as she. So I went to my list. I had this ongoing list of artists that I want to work with, and the list includes superstars and the list includes new stars, and Grace was at the top of that list. When I first heard her cover of You Don't Own Me, which was her big hit a year or so ago, I was completely blown away. She's 19 years old and had such a soulful voice and such a powerful voice. I knew right then I wanted to work with her. You know, it's very hard to cover a song and
make it your own?
Any justice.
Right.
I mean, you know, Whitney Houston, I'm Every Woman, Mary J. Blige, I'm Going Down, Lauryn Hill, I Can't Take My Eyes Off of You. These are rare exceptions. And she was one of those exceptions, and I knew I wanted to work with her, and she seemed like she could do this. So I reached out to her. I sent her the song. She was very enthusiastic about meeting, and she wanted to try it. You know, she was very humble. Not, I'm going to do this. I want to try it. And I flew to Atlanta.
So some artists come in, and, you know, you play them a song. They haven't rehearsed. They haven't studied. They haven't listened to the song. And they think they're just going to record it amazingly well. And, you know, Grace is not that type. She had been really living with the song, and you could tell. And she went in to record it and recorded it with flying colors. And she was indeed the right person. I went home and I wanted a male perspective, a male voice, a male response. And I wanted the response to be through the language of hip hop. So like with singers, I have a list of rappers that I want to work with, some superstars, you know, some new stars, and Yachty was at the top of that list. I was immediately drawn to Yachty from the first time I saw him. Stylistically, we have a lot in common. Like me, he's bold, he's bright, he's, you know, vivid, he's playful, and that's rare these days, and I love that about him, and I respect that about him. And musically, I love his voice and his tone, and I think he's introspective but playful, and I really think that he's kind of a new voice of his generation. And I also love the fact that I knew people would be shocked to hear that DJ Cassidy and Lil Yachty on a song together. And people were shocked when I started to tell people. They couldn't understand our common ground. They couldn't see what we had in common. And I'm so happy that we got to prove those people wrong. I think Yachty, you know, showed a new side of himself on this record. And so I hadn't met Yachty. I went from New York City to Philly. He was performing on a Ray Strum show. It was a Ray Strum Lil Yachty show. And I went backstage, and I had a brooch on of a sailboat, a vintage brooch of a sailboat. And you know, of course, I had the boater hat on. And he saw the brooch before I could even say anything. So we hit it off, and I told him about the project, and he was like, I'm down. And there was a studio next door to the venue that I had found before I had gone. I had already booked it before I even went. So I told him I had the studio booked next door. He was like, what? He's like, you're not playing around. So we went to the studio after the show, and I showed him these videos that I've released with each of my singles, the behind-the-scenes videos. Not the music videos, the behind-the-scenes videos. So Calling All Hearts featuring Robin Thicke and Jesse J, Make the World Go Round featuring R. Kelly, Future Is Mine featuring Chromeo and Wale. And he sees these kind of legendary musicians of the late 70s and early 80s that I recruited for some of those records. And he was really inspired by that, by the musicality of my sound. And he was like, I'm so down for this. And he asked me if he could see Grace's lyrics. And I had them. And he studied them. And he really sought to, you know, reply to her, you know, from a male teenage perspective. You know, he's 19 as well. And that's exactly what he did. And he replied very insightfully and thoughtfully to her standpoint. And I think that both guys and girls can relate to what they're both singing about.
Yeah, I have to say that there's a lot of portions of the song that I really, really do love. But there's something about the way he responds, and the very last thing he says is, please come home. I don't know why, but that is just like my favorite part of the whole song.
Well, because it shows humility.
Yeah.
You know, and in so much of our music, not today, for decades, in so much of male music, not just in hip hop and rock and roll and you know, in R&B too, in so much of male music, there's so much bravado, and it's so inspiring to hear a male artist, particularly a young male artist, you know, be humble and ask for forgiveness. And I think that's why, you know, people are responding to it so well, particularly, you know, from him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a rising rapper, the whole thing is about bravado, and the whole image is about bravado, and And this is one of those things where, you know, the girl is more important. The relationship is more important than all of those things.
I think for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a perspective that a lot of people can relate to. Now, you mentioned that you have this incredible list of, like, a wish list. And it made me really curious, given some of the artists you've already worked with, who's on your wish list?
Oh, The Weeknd, Bruno Mars, Justin Timberlake, Miguel. Those are four examples of superstars that I'd love to work with. Then there's an artist named Khalid, K-H-A-L-I-D, brand new artist.
Right.
Just released his first album.
Location, cool. Right?
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. And I love his whole record, and I'd love to work with him. Who else? The list is just so long. Well, anyway, you know, those are good examples. You know, superstars to new stars of people who I'd love to work with.
One of the most interesting collaborations for me that you've done, and it's because of the fact that I've worked with him in the past, and I think he's so incredibly talented, and he's also wildly colorful in his own very special way, is Alex Newell. And I think that he really has a strong connection to the gay community, but I would never see him as somebody who necessarily I would have imagined you working with or recording a record with. And tell me about that.
Well, I met Alex Newell through Craig Kalman, who's the chairman of Atlantic Records. When he first signed Alex, he called me over to his house to play me his music, and we both discussed how much Alex reminded us of Sylvester.
Of course.
And Craig and I both wanted, Craig wanted me to, and I wanted to produce a song for Alex that would allude to the spirit of Sylvester. And we created Kill the Lights long before vinyl was ever a thing. And Atlantic was putting out the soundtrack for vinyl. And so Craig Kalman was on set, and they were looking for a song to fill this part of the script where they were essentially discovering this new dance music that went on to be called disco. And Craig played the demo of Kill the Lights on set, and Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger ran over Shazamming the song. What is this? What is this? And he said, it's a brand new song that DJ Cassidy did with my new singer, Alex Newell. And they said, this has to be in the show. And basically three episodes ended up essentially revolving around this record. And it really was going to be a DJ Cassidy record featuring Alex Newell, or an Alex Newell record featuring DJ Cassidy. And we had it on the back burner for when the time was right, because I had just put a song out and he had just put a song out, so the time wasn't right then. And the show just made it all make sense. And that's how he and I came together.
Well, Alex is so crazy. I worked with him on stage. I produced an event a few years ago, and he was one of our headlining acts, and he's just so crazy talented. Oh, my God. His voice is insane.
Oh, his voice is incredible. I mean, his voice is one of the best voices of his generation. He is going to be a superstar. There is no doubt in my mind. There are a few voices like his every generation, and I feel lucky to have worked with him so early on.
And when you draw the comparison to Sylvester, I could see how that would be appealing to you, given the fact that you've brought in people like Nile Rodgers and all these classic disco funk era musicians. So wanting to work with an artist and kind of sculpt an artist whose voice is so perfectly attuned to a sound that seems to kind of inspired you and influenced you, or that you'd like to recreate in many ways, with a very modern twist, I could see how that would be really appealing.
100%. I mean, I can't say it any better than you just did.
So tell me about this fascination that you have with these classic musicians.
Well, I was a hip-hop kid growing up, asked my parents for two turntables and a mixer for my 10th birthday, idolized Run DMC, and like all my friends, I was closed-minded. I thought that to fully embrace hip-hop, you had to hate everything else. Like to embrace Tupac, you had to hate, Kurt Cobain. But I discovered, a decade after their rise, Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, and Grandmaster Flash, more than a decade after their rise, And I looked at them as superheroes, which is interesting because Baz Luhrmann in The Get Down has now portrayed them as such in his animated portions of the show, even on the first half of the season when the Grandmaster Flash character is like you're jumping over like the roofs of the projects in the South Bronx. He also portrays them as superheroes, these larger-than-life people, and they were fascinating to me. And I realized that they weren't playing hip-hop, you know, as young DJs, because there was no hip-hop. They were creating it by playing all kinds of music, not only the obvious funk, soul, disco, R&B, you know, but rock and roll, reggae, Latin music, and everything under the sun to create this new music. And that fascinated me, and that completely opened up my mind. And, you know, every weekend my dad would take me downtown to the record stores. Now, in addition to looking for the new Naughty by Nature or the new Tribe Called Quest, I was going to the, you know, to the oldie record stores and allowing each record cover, the artwork, the liner notes, to lead me to the next. And, you know, I sought to be an encyclopedia of music. I wanted to be the DJ that could play all music for all people all over the world. That was my motto as a young teen, still very much is. That motto kind of lies at the foundation of my success as a DJ, I believe. And, you know, the dance music of the late 70s, early 80s, which is the music that went on to inspire the music that I produce, in a very natural, unintentional way, became kind of my love and almost what I was known for in many ways. And one night that foreshadowed it was I was 18, 19 years old, playing at this hot club in New York City, Lotus. And it was pouring rain. Hottest club in town, but kind of very empty night, 3 a.m. And Puffy comes out of the corner of the room. And Puffy was king of all parties, king of New York. You know, Diddy runs the city. And he comes and starts dancing to this music. And he ends up dancing till 5 in the morning. We stayed open an hour late. And he walks by at the end of the night, sees me in the DJ booth. And he says, "Where's the DJ?" I say, "I'm the DJ." And he says, "Who's been playing these classic records all night?" I say, "Me." And he says, "Call me tomorrow." And he writes down his name and number on a napkin. I was a freshman at NYU at the time. And I was so nervous to call. Finally, he got the balls to dial the number. And I got his voicemail. I said, "God is the greatest." Beep. And I'm like, "What?" And I stammer my way through a voicemail. And I'm like, "All right, that's the end of that. It was fun while it lasted." You know, he does this every night. He's never calling back. And I went to class and I got out. And his assistant, I called back. "Please call back. You know, please call Mr. Combs back at the office." I ran home, still lived with my mother, and locked myself in the room. So nervous to call. And before I could say, "Hi, it's DJ Cassidy," he got on the phone. And he said, "Playboy." He said, "How old did you say you were?" I said, 18. He said, "I've never heard a young white boy play soul music like that before. Like, how do you know those records and how do you know how to play them like that? Like you lived it." And, you know, I had no idea. I didn't even know I did that. And he said, "I'm throwing a party for the MTV Awards next week, and I want you to do it." So a week later, I was in a room with, you know, every star in the entertainment world. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to have many career-defining nights like that. But that was one that really ignited so much. But it also answers your question. It foreshadows how this music played a part unintentionally in my career, in my life. And that music became, you know, what I love, but also became what I was known for. By no means is it what I play, you know, everywhere I go. I mean, there's nights where I don't play any of it, but it's always, I always find ways to infuse a little of it, but more importantly, the spirit of that music in everything I do, no matter what genre I'm playing and who I'm playing for. And it really became a part of my signature sound. And I always wanted to, you know, I wanted there to be new music that felt like that, you know, that had that spirit and emotion and sound. And then I just decided to do it myself and recruit a lot of the musicians that played on those records from the late 70s and early 80s, the guys from Earth, Wind & Fire and Nile from Chic and the guys from Rufus and you know, the musicians that played on Off the Wall from Michael and Quincy. And, you know, no matter if there's a track where, you know, it's all live or not live at all or somewhat live, you know, the spirit of the music is always alive, you know, in what I do.
And I think that you intuitively, at a very young age, kind of foresaw what we are seeing currently in the music industry, because a lot of the artists that were on your list of superstars you want to work with and people that you've already worked with, like Robin Thicke and Justin Timberlake and Bruno Mars, these are all people who I really believe have ushered back in and or recreated a sound that was classically considered that of the late 70s, that funk style that is so popular now, is a real throwback to a lot of that musically.
Yeah, you know, I'm not, you know, I would never say that I don't like to claim that I was able to foreshadow or predict anything, but there had definitely been in the past 5 years some amazing records that have come out by young artists who have also been inspired by this era of music. And I could not have been more thrilled. You know, there was something in the air. You know, when things like this happen, we're not all talking to each other, right? So how does that happen? There's something in the air. You know, we feel, you know, the dance floor needed it. And we all must have felt it.
You know, the best DJs for party environments are people who kind of give both the throwbacks and the current and contemporary music. But one of the things I think is happening now is that because of the musical trends, it's making that possible a little more seamlessly. You know, there's not as much of a jarring juxtaposition between the sounds that are classic from the 70s and even into the 80s and what's contemporary now. You know, the music cycle has evolved to the point where we know that musically everything that's old, it becomes new again. You know what I mean? Eventually. It's the same with fashion. And right now the music is definitely tipping its hat to the sounds that were prominent in the 80s and in the 70s before that. You see a lot of comparisons to people vocally between Michael Jackson and Prince, for example, because that is what has become the trend again.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, musically speaking, I think the trend that you're signifying lies heavily in the use of live musicianship and the inspiration from dance music that was created by musicians. Hip hop and house music both took dance music out of its live space.
Yeah.
In very good ways. In very positive ways, by the way. But I think artists like me and some of the artists you're referencing love that last era of dance music that was created by live musicians, and we're all inspired it so much that we've all kind of decided to create music that feels like that.
Well, let me tell you, I saw a Clean Bandit show a couple weeks ago. And, you know, people think of Clean Bandit and they probably immediately think of synth pop or whatever. And they had live instrumentation on the stage and it made the experience so much richer. You know what I mean? So I think that the inclusion of live instrumentation again versus having a guy on a keyboard replicating all those songs, which is great in its own right, but I think it changes the experience.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm talking to you right now from Russell Simmons' house, which is where I stay in LA. And I tell you that because one of my favorite songs of all time and my favorite hip hop song of all time is Run DMC Sucker MCs. And there is no music in that song other than a drum machine, a kick, a snare, and a clap. There are no keyboards, there is no bass line, there are no live instruments. It is a kick, a snare, and a clap from a drum machine. It is the rawest form of hip-hop, and in my opinion, its greatest form. If an alien came from outer space and said, what is hip-hop, I would show them a picture of Run DMC and play them Sucker MCs still today. So there is nothing wrong with raw and machine, and there is, quite the contrary, everything beautiful about, and incredible about raw and machine. But that's not to say that, contrarily, that amazing dance music was made in a particular era with live musicianship. And like hip-hop, that era of music also really touched me. And I've always been inspired to create music that feels like that, because as a DJ, I feel like it creates an emotion and a spirit on the dance floor like no other kind of music.
I want to talk to you about your fashion, because going back to the video for Honor, it is very fashion rich. It's very color rich. And you are known, of course, in huge part for your very unique and brightly colored fashion sense. And I was wondering what shaped that.
Well, the simple answer is I don't know. my mother has a kindergarten class picture where all the boys are dressed in matching after-school sports uniforms, and I'm in the middle wearing red high-top canvas Chuck Taylors, red pants rolled up real short like Michael Jackson, and a white Mickey Mouse sweatshirt. So looking back to when I was 5 years old, it seems I've always dressed in my own unique way and cared about what I was wearing and always beat to my own drum. You know, how and why, you know, and where that started, I couldn't tell you. But as early as 5, I was rolling my pants up short to emulate Michael Jackson. You know, still to this day, people say, who are your number one fashion influences? And my answers always surprise them. I say Michael Jackson and Run-DMC. And they say, how so? And I say, well, I wear a boater hat. That's a fedora. Both Michael Jackson and Run-DMC were known, their silhouettes include fedoras, they're known for fedoras. I wear, you know, brooches on my jackets and sweaters that came from Michael Jackson. I wear crests on my sweaters that came from Michael Jackson. I wear my pants short that came from Michael Jackson. I wear leather suits that came from Run-DMC. I wear vintage, like, you know, necklaces and chains that came from Run-DMC. Theirs weren't vintage. Theirs were gold like, you know, rope chains, but it's, you know, all the same thing. You know, I wear a lot of athletic wear, you know, and tracksuit that came from Run-DMC. So my fedoras, my brooches, my crests, my necklaces, my leather suits, my athletic wear. I mean, I just named, you know, so much of what I wear. By far, not everything I wear comes from them, but so much of the broader strokes come from, you know, my two idols in music. You know, the boater hat has become my signature, and it happened so naturally, it's almost, you know, funny because it was so unintentional. I started experimenting with fedoras over 10 years ago, and it took me several years to stumble upon the boater. I tried all kinds, you know, black fedoras, white fedoras, gray fedoras, you know, felt fur, you know, straw in the hot weather, you know, white brim, you know, short brim. But I stumbled upon the boater and I liked it because I've always been drawn to things that had kind of a classic appeal, a timeless appeal, an iconic appeal that goes for music and fashion, obviously. And you don't see anyone wearing boater hats. You don't see, you know, young people or old people wearing boater hats, particularly young. And I like that. And I like that, you know, I can wear it with a tracksuit as much as I can a tuxedo. And it makes me in either way. And no matter what I'm wearing, you know, if you go through my Instagram, whether it's, you know, tuxedo to the Oscars or an athletic outfit to the boardwalk in, you know, Venice, or one of my custom tweed Chanel inspired, you know, blazers, no matter what I'm wearing, the boater hat is the igniting factor. And it always makes every outfit, no matter how dressed up or dressed as, me. And that's what I, you know, love about it.
This latest track, the Honor track, is not listed as being from an album. Is there an album that's coming that will include it?
Well, you know, when I released my first single, Calling All Hearts, with Robin Thicke and Jesse J, I intended on releasing the album with that single. I intended on releasing all these songs as an EP or an LP. And I shot a music video, and then I shot a making of video that showed me the studio with Earth, Wind & Fire and Nile Rodgers and Jesse and Robin. And I toured, and I was putting so much into each song, so much blood, sweat, tears, and time into every record, you know, pursuing musicians, pursuing artists, that by the time I released my second single with R. Kelly, Make the World Go Round, and then my third feature is mine with Chromeo and Wale, it became clear that I was treating each single, and my record label was treating each single as an event. And I liked that because, you know, as a result, treated each record as, you know, work of art. I was putting as much time into a single, you know, as people were used to putting into albums. And so I started to enjoy this process of putting each, you know, single out song by song. And it also complemented this modern day digital era that we're in when everyone can buy every song individually anyway.
Right.
They're not forced to buy your whole album and listen to it from beginning to end. So why not put as much into each song as you would the whole project? So I started to enjoy that process. And this, as the fifth single, I continue to enjoy that process.
Yeah, I was wondering if there was an influence from the changing environment of music, downloadable music today, that made you steer away from that idea of the album. I think that for so long people were hooked on the idea of I've got to put out an album. But now I think more and more artists are very inclined and interested in doing the one-off projects because, exactly as you said, you can put out individual pieces of music that you're really proud of versus the fear or the pressure to put out an entire body of work, some of which you may not think it needs to be there.
For sure. For sure. I think that in an era when we can buy every song individually, you need to put as much into every song as you would an album. And, you know, through the process which I've described and how I create these records, you can see how I was already doing that. So for me, this process has worked and made sense and been successful.
Yeah, besides the fact that as a person who grew up in an age when you could not buy individual things other than as a cassette single or some stupid thing like that, I can't tell you how many entire cassettes or CDs or whatever I bought and only liked one song or two songs, maybe three songs if it was a good album. There's something definitely to be said for focusing on quality versus quantity of content.
For sure.
Well, Cassidy, I'm really grateful that you took time to talk to me today, and I know that you got other things to do, but I really appreciate it. And I
No. Thank you. Look, anyone who wants to talk to me about my music, I'm grateful for. So thank you.
Yeah, and I look forward to more superstar collaborations, and I consider Grace and Yachty superstar collaboration because it brings artists that we are not as familiar with to the forefront with a great
100%.
Project. 100%. Yeah, I'm actually super excited to see more about Grace. I love her voice. I'm excited that you're exposing her to an all-new audience of people who presumably might not have heard from her. And I hope it opens great doors for her.
I do too. I think it will. I'm sure it will.
Have a great day and best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Hey, y'all. This is Bob the Drag Queen. You are listening to Party Foul Radio with Toyo Del Mar and Pearl. Listen up, girl.
All right, everybody. We are back with more Party Foul Radio. I'm Poyo Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Tease.
And we just heard from DJ Cassidy talking about his new single, Honor. Go check it out. It's featuring Grace and Lil Yachty.
All right, Grace and Lil Yachty.
Uh-huh.
I like Grace. She's the same one who sang...
You Don't Own Me?
The remake to You Don't Own Me for this Suicide Squad soundtrack.
And he actually, as he said on the interview, he said that that's where he heard her, and he really loves her voice. And
she's amazing.
She is amazing. And I'm looking forward to more from her, and as I said to him, I'm hoping this kind of launches her to a new audience of people. You know, she's still emerging. She's Australian, and she's just kind of getting some exposure.
And, you know, I think she really fits with, like, the new pop that's out right now.
Yeah.
So, good luck to her.
My fear is that, you know, somebody who's, for example, I don't know why I make a correlation to between her and, like, Joss Stone, but I think it's because her voice is really rich and kind of soulful. Okay. And Joss Stone is somebody who I wanted to see such big things from.
She has an amazing voice.
Amazing voice. But it just sort of never went anywhere for her. I don't know.
I mean, she just did, never mind. That's Tori Kelly. Never mind.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Joss Stone didn't do shit.
Right.
But anyway, you guys, we are recording this podcast a day early because Pearl has a big audition tomorrow.
I do have an audition tomorrow. I am auditioning for the world-renowned Asia SF. it's something I kind of wanted to do for, like, the longest time. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Wish me luck, you guys.
Yes, we do wish you luck. Before we go any further in the podcast, we definitely need to give a shout-out, so it's not the very last minute, to our sponsoring organizations.
Yes, girl. If y'all need a haircut, y'all know to go down to Daddy's Barbershop on 19th and Castro.
Yes. And, you know, it's funny because I took my friend Brian Lynn into Daddy's Barbershop a while back to get his hair cut by the ever-adorable Lorenzo. And somebody asked him recently, where do you get your hair done? And he said, oh, ever since Poyo told me about Daddy's, I've been going to Daddy's, and now I tell everybody about Daddy's. So, word of mouth works, girl. He heard about it from us. Now he's getting his hair did there and telling everybody about it. So, go on down to Daddy's Barbershop and check them out. Of course, we are sitting here staring at hundreds of dollars in Swiss Navy lube.
So, go ahead and get your lubricants and things.
That's Swiss Navy lube. Go out to your premium lubricant dealership and find that at your adult toy store.
Right, there's a lubricant for everybody.
And a lubricant for every hole, bitch.
Right.
Every part of you's got a lubricant. Different one.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget to check out our sponsors over at Left Magazine at liveleft.com.
And I want to give a shout out to Robert Manzer and the crew over at GuideToGay.com. Australia's premier LGBT information and entertainment website. Go check them out, guidetogay.com. Hopefully, fingers crossed, eventually Pearl and I are going to get our asses down under.
You know.
So, Robert, maybe you guys should start brewing up some ideas.
Yeah,
maybe
save those coins, girl, because we are ready.
Ellen Friedman at Swiss Navy, you know, next time you have to go down there for a gay Mardi Gras, bitch, you got a podcast that wants to go with you.
Speaking of which, do we have a date?
Actually, Pearl, now that you're mentioning it, let me just pull up this email, because I promised the people at the Eagle just emailed me, and these are the dates that they said. What about June 10th or June 24th? June 3rd is...
Girl, June 24th is the day before Pride, and I might be able to do June 10th.
So, we had originally asked for June 3rd, you guys, because Pearl said that was the only weekend in June that she was not booked already or whatever. But I could swear she told me something was on the 10th of June. We are trying to get our lube wrestling for charity on, girl.
Where in the hell is my... Here's my calendar.
Come on.
So, June...
10th. Come on, June 10th. What's on June 10th?
I am going to
That's the 18th, bitch.
I know. I'll be in Seattle that weekend.
I knew you said something that was that weekend. She's going up there for her Miss Nubian Pride step down.
Yes, girl.
I've got it on good faith that Pearl's costumes are cute. So...
Yeah,
she's going to be that kind of step down because her costumes are cute.
It's going to be that kind of step down, girl.
Anyway, so I don't know what even that means, but...
I don't know what that means either, but girl, eat it.
So, fuck, I need to get back to them. Maybe we have to do the beginning of July.
Oh, that breaks my heart. Hold, that's the only time in June they're available. Really, the day before... Okay, so time out. Okay, so hold on.
June 24th is the day before Pride. Actually, it's the Saturday of Pride.
It's the Saturday of Pride, girl.
But that could be a really good weekend because the whole city's going to be full of homosexuals, girl. We could get homosexuals from everywhere.
I have a gig later that night. Let me see what time that gig starts and what time I have to be there.
Oh, girl, I think that is the day for us, bitch. Lube wrestling? You can imagine how many people would come and see lube wrestling.
I would live. So let me just...
Okay, you better get on it, bitch.
I'm going to talk to the girl that I...
We could make so much money, bitch. We could have we could have a new computer, bitch.
Girl,
there'll be a new computer up in this house, bitch. Get on it, girl.
I'll check.
Oh, girl, we don't even need you there.
You're such a shady bitch.
Oh, girl, I just want the money.
Give me the money.
Right,
I'll try to figure it out by the end of this week. Do they know that that's Pride weekend? You might want to remind them.
Remind them it's Pride weekend, but, girl, maybe I'll be like, you promised us, bitch! Right. Oh, no!
This is during the day, too.
Yeah, it'd be during the day. It's like 4 to 7 or something. Girl, because if you're in town for Pride over the weekend of, you know, San Francisco Pride... Saturday is part of Pride, but it's boring at AF downtown.
Especially during the day.
Girl, yeah, dead AF, okay? It's like a flea market.
Right.
It's like all kinds of vendors and whatever. When you could come and see lube wrestling, bitch.
Girl, lube wrestling.
Oh, yes. All those sexy menses greased up with Swiss Navy premium lubricants.
Right.
Perliqua in her crop top Foot Locker referee shirt.
You know.
Getting all greased up in our kiddie pool.
Oh, girl.
Oh, yes. She gonna be slipping and sliding, bitch. Somebody accidentally slip and penetrate her.
I will be so pissed if I fall into that mess. I can't wait, though. It's going to be so much fun.
All right, you guys. I think that's it for this episode. This has been episode 64 of Party Foul Radio. I'm going to be working on getting us even more fabulous interviews for upcoming episodes. A girl I called John Edwards, by the way, today. I called and left a message for him. I was like, hello. You should have known I was calling, bitch.
I'm ready for my,
She's ready for a psychic reading, girl. So, since she's ready, you guys, I'm going to start reading, but I think this is the end of the podcast because I don't need it on air. Her saying, oh, you're just a bitch. Oh, you're such an awful bitch.
You know it's true. All right.
Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I'm gonna see if my best friend sent me this message earlier that I did not listen to.
I have lived.
I love it. I live.
That's my best friend Shigella saying how, quoting Pearl, I have lived.
I love it.
Oh, my God. Oh, dear. He was like, because I said, he said something. He goes, oh, Jesus, you're old. And I said, thanks, Pearl. And then he says, I have lived.
I love it.
I said, I know I can't listen right now, but I'm sure you sound like the Cleveland show.
Oh, my
like,
God.
I have lived.
Too bad she died.
So, well, that's his impression of you, bitch.
Oh, my God. A mess.
I live.
All right, you guys.
All right. We will see you guys or talk to you next week. Remember, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, at Party Foul Radio. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Poet Omar.
And I'm Pearl T.
Until next time.
I have lived.
Bye.
Work, it's over. Work, it's over.